The catastrophic effects of an electromagnetic pulse caused blackout could be preventable, but experts warn that the civilian world still is not ready. Peter Vincent Pry, who's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum, told both congressional advisory boards that the technology to avoid disaster from EMP pulses exists, and upgrading the nation's electrical grid is financially viable. Well, in a moment, we're going to be talking about Behold a Pale Farce, cyber war, threat inflation, and the malware industrial complex. Bill Blunden joins us, and we're going to be talking about what is happening with so many people who are just simply saying we're on the brink of a catastrophe. What does he say next on Coast to Coast AM? And welcome back to Coast. We're going to bring you a different perspective. Behold a Pale Farce. Bill Blunden, independent investigator, current areas of inquiry touch on information security, anti-forensics, and institutional analysis. Over the past couple decades, he has performed research and development for companies, developed tools for network security appliances. He's majored in physics as an undergrad at Cornell University, completed a Master of Science degree in operations research from Case Western Reserve University as well. He has written the book called Behold a Pale Farce with Violet. And Bill, you're going to have to help me with her last name, but I would pronounce it Chiang. How'd I do?
Pretty good. It's Chiang.
Chiang. Very good. And she, of course, has been a professor of psychology at the University of San Francisco, right?
Yes.
Super. Now, tell me a little bit about you, though. That's what I'm interested in.
Well, I started off in physics, and when I got out, I realized that there wasn't necessarily a demand for physicists to fight, despite what I might have thought. And so I ended up kind of redirecting myself a little bit, and I developed an interest in computers, and then eventually kind of low-level, system-level software. And from there, it kind of moved pretty naturally to security. And that's where I kind of melded different areas of interest and started looking at rootkit technology, which is really kind of where a lot of different disciplines intersect. You know, you have forensic technology that there are aspects of it. There's system level aspects where you're manipulating an operating system features and components. And there's normal application level features you would add, you know, like command and control and covert channels and remote access. And, you know, so I use that kind of just one thing kind of just organically led to the next. But I started, you know, I follow the news. I read it daily. Mm-hmm. And I started hearing these stories in the news, and I realized, wait a minute, these proclamations that I'm hearing about the end times, they don't seem to make any sense based on, you know, the data that I had collected and I had access to. I looked at what they were saying. I looked at what I knew in terms of factual evidence, and I said, there's definitely a disconnect here. There's something going on. Given a message which is a misdiagnosis, and what's worse is that the solutions that they're being prescribed by these same officials and politicians and think tank people, these solutions are also bad. They're counterproductive. So I realized, you know, this is not a good thing. You know, usually when you go to the doctor, you know, you need to have a proper diagnosis, and then the prescription also has to be appropriate. And I realized it was wrong on both cases, and so I started doing more research on this, and I did some presentations about it. And as word kind of got around as to what I was doing, I got a call from a publisher here in the Bay Area, and they were interested in, you know, me writing a book on cyber war,
He probably said, "What cyber war?"
absolutely. That being my main thesis is that there's a farce here, and it's the farce of cyber war. And as I progressed with the book, you know, after about 6 months or so, the publisher called me in, the senior editor, and he said, well, you know what? We're concerned about the tone of your book. We're particularly concerned about the coverage you give to former Director of National Intelligence, Mike McConnell, who is now a Booz Allen VP. Then at one point, they mentioned the presidential election of 2012. And at that point, I probably should have hit, the alarm should have gone off, but they didn't. So eventually I ended up having to find another publisher that was a little more intrepid.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And that was a lot of effort, but I found Chris Milligan over at Trinday, and he is not someone who's easy to bully. So I felt, you know, I'd seen other books that he'd published that, you know, were pretty bold, and I said that this is probably the guy I want to work with. And sure enough, you know, I was lucky.
Do you miss physics at all?
I'd say physics broke my heart. You know, I worked so hard. I studied 10 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, and for 5 to 6 months at a time. I was on a mission from the emperor. You know, devoted myself to it and sacrificed a lot. I sacrificed basically everything for it. And when I got out, I realized, you know, wasn't necessarily a good investment. So I was kind of disappointed. And I think I keep my physics textbooks. I have a lot of them. I keep them in boxes down in the basement, so I don't have to look at them. So,
Bill, you know, we're going to talk about a lot of different aspects of this, but you key in primarily, not on Armageddon as it would relate to some kind of earth calamity or something. You look at this from the perspective of cyber attacks, cyber war, and you basically believe, I'm not going to say nonsense, but you don't think it's going to happen.
Well, in terms of hard quantitative kind of statistical analysis, there haven't been any instances of cyber Armageddon. If there were, we would have known about it already. The problem with this is that the people who are promoting this, who are conveying this message, they act as though they could predict it. And once more, they tend to focus on all the negative consequences. And that's really their forte. That's where they excel. It's like telling you how bad it's going to be. And this is their tell, you know, this is where they're indicating what's going on, because this message isn't intended to appeal to reason. It's there to induce an emotional response. And that is an indicator that the propaganda tool called threat inflation is being used. And we saw this earlier, before we invaded Iraq, when our leadership was telling us about the smoking gun that came in the form of a mushroom cloud. And I think we heard a couple of people use that metaphor. And this kind of message, it stokes anxiety, and it kind of foments a crisis mentality.
Fear sells.
Yes, yes. It's not so much fear, because fear paralyzes. It's anxiety, because anxiety spurs action. When someone's scared, they kind of cower and they don't take much action. And this is kind of the misnomer that it's all about fear. It's not about fear. It's about anxiety, because anxiety spurs you into action. When you're anxious about a test, you start doing things. You start cramming. You do something. So when you're in this crisis mentality and you're anxious, people who get into that frame of consciousness, they'll pay any price to be safe. There's problems with that, because then you become susceptible to preconceived solutions.
Now, are you saying that there will not be cyber attacks ever, or are you just saying right now?
Well, nobody knows, but I'd say, you know, the troubles that we face on a day-to-day basis are probably the ones we really need to address. I think that, you know, there are lots of types of insurance you can buy, right? And you can think, well, what's going to, you know, and an anxious person, you know, you don't want to be anxious and buy insurance. A rational person won't pay any amount of money to be safe. They choose insurance carefully. They decide, okay, what's my exposure? What's the likelihood of something happening? What's the cost benefit of this? And they do an assessment that's careful, and then they make a decision. But when you're in that crisis mentality and you're thinking, You know, you're not thinking rationally, you're thinking viscerally. And when you're in that state of mind, you're in a position where you can waste a lot of resources and yield up your civil liberties and try to protect yourself at a very high cost. And in doing so, you neglect other threats, which probably are more genuine and more serious. You know, there's an intelligence agent from England who said, are we going to remake our world to face one threat and in doing so neglect all the other threats that are out there that are far, you know, more tangible, more immediate? And I think there are immediate tangible threats out there, but I don't see, you know, they talk about the power grid, you know, and that's probably one of the threats of the day that, you know, you hear people talk about. And
I just had that story before you came on that, you know, one of the consultants for Homeland Security is saying, we got to fix the grid. It's feasible. Let's do it.
So in 2012, the Government Accounting Office published a report called Cybersecurity, Challenges in Securing the Modernized Electricity Grid. And in the report, it's 19 pages or so. There's no examples of any blackouts caused by cyber attacks. And this is kind of the illusion that there's some sort of big red switch somewhere where you can knock everything out, when the truth is more like we have something like over 1,600 providers who are at the bulk, you know, the bulk electrical level where they're it's past 100 kilovolts. And, you know, there was a Wired article that was kind of brilliantly summarized this. You know, the title was Hacking the Electric Grid. You and what army? Huh. You know, in other words, it's not as easy as you think. There's so many dependencies, so many different pieces moving around.
Yeah, it's not that these people don't want to do it. I'm convinced, Bill, that there are some people out there who hate our guts and would love to bring us down any way they could.
Yeah, I mean, and if it were that easy, they already would have done it.
That's true. It's easier for a tree limb to fall on a power line and knock out the power.
Yes. And in fact, that is a scenario that I believe, I'm trying to think if it's Keith Alexander or Mike McConnell used. They used that as an example. Well, you could knock the power out. And the example they're actually using is a tree falling down on a power line, causing, you know, and they're just extrapolating that thing.
Widespread outages.
That could be a cyber attack. That's how their approach is. And there was a study in 2011 from MIT that said, despite the alarmist rhetoric, there is no crisis here. The former cyber czar of Obama's, Howard Schmidt, he said, I just don't see how that's realistic. He doesn't, you know, there's like I said, there's thousands of providers out there, all these systems. And to knock to wipe them all out in a fell swoop, it doesn't seem realistic to me either. The executives who head up, there's the chief executive NERC, that's the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. His name's Gary Cawley, and he says, you know, that there's never been a destructive cyber attack on the grid, and they're far more concerned about physical threats. And there's right. actually good reason for that. You know, for example, in the summer of 2013 in San Jose, someone took a high-powered rifle and started shooting transformer at PG&E. And then, you know, shortly afterwards in the fall of 2013 in Arkansas, somebody stole a tractor and used it to down some power lines. So I think that, you know, in terms of if you look at your data sets here, I think that they're right on the money. You know, the physical threat is far higher.
Oh, I think so too. We're very vulnerable to those.
Yes. So, you know, in some instances, we're even our own worst enemy. You know, that we had rolling blackouts in California back in June of 2000, right? But that wasn't a cyber attack. That was, you know, kind of deregulation and, you know, market manipulation by companies like Enron. And, you know, in that sense, you know, the threat is almost internal. So I don't see the power grid necessarily as you know, being just something you could just switch off. And, you know, we have to necessarily make that our primary concern. I think we have other concerns and other threats that have a much higher risk associated.
Now, you don't put hacking into this bundle, though, do you? I mean, because, you know, for example, all those people who got hacked at Target.
Right,
you know,
right.
That, you know, millions of people there. I mean, that is real, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That is a serious threat. It's not an existential threat, but it's a serious threat. It definitely needs to be addressed. It's something, it's concrete and tangible. That's, we don't need to worry about cyber war. We definitely need to address cyber crime. We also need to address espionage. You know, those are problems that actually lead to losses. But I don't think they're existential problems. For example, the one thing that people like to, especially these officials who talk about cyber war, they like to point to China. Yeah, that's probably their boogeyman of choice. And they think that China is behind all these attacks on the United States.
Aren't they?
Well, I'll tell you what, they're leveraging, again, you know, this is another technique. It's kind of a psychological ploy they're using. It's a tendency for that humans have in general, and it's called outgroup homogeneity bias.
What the heck is that?
Well, it means you look over at China and you neglect to see the diversity that kind of exists over there and the different things that are going on. And all you see is one big united horde of hackers aimed by the government at you.
Yeah. In some building, just working away.
Yeah. And the truth is that there are a lot of actors that are doing things in China. There's organized crime. There's foreign spies who are launching false flag operations. There are rogue bureaucrats like Bo Xilai. There are corporate spies. And this isn't the result of some thousand-year plan by the Chinese government. You know, it's more a function of their waning control.
I mean, we do hear stories of, you know, the possibility that the Chinese would love to develop the ability to take out satellites, that they've experimented with taking out one of their own. Mm-hmm. And it works. I mean, I think those are real threats, Bill, don't you?
They are, but I don't think that all the attacks coming out of China can really be attributed to the Chinese government. Obviously, every government is involved with stuff to some extent or another. I think we're probably more involved than anyone else when it comes down to it, in terms of the sheer amount of money that we push into
it. Oh, ours, we must be huge for that kind of spying.
So I'd say that a lot of stuff that's coming out of China, it's more a function of the kind of the lack of the breakdown of rule of law in China. You have this rampant corruption in China, and it kind of originates from decades ago when Deng Xiaoping was in charge. He launched some political and economic reforms. He started to decentralize power and to allow economic reforms to kind of set in, where he allowed some people to get rich first. I guess that's the quote he used. And the end result of this was this mind-boggling corruption. As a result of this corruption, China struggles just to function, just to deliver basic services. Even that is a struggle for China. They're just trying to keep their act together. For example, look at Beijing, the pollution in Beijing. You have to wear one of those, you know, 3M, M95 masks. There's no way around it. You have to wear it. And some days you can't see 3 feet in front of your face. It's so bad. Tax collection. This is something that actually, without a doubt, benefits the government, and they still have a hard time collecting taxes. But to give you an idea of the scope of the corruption, recently, I think yesterday in the New York Times, there was a story. The leadership in China is going after the former security chief. His name is Yao Yongkang. And the government that's now trying to go after him for corruption, they seized assets from his relatives and associates. And the amount that they've seized is something on the order of $14.5 billion.
Wow.
Yeah. So that gives you the idea of the graft that's going on. There's an awful lot of money being sucked out. And as a result,
how did they accumulate that kind of wealth?
That's real corruption.
My gosh.
Yeah.
All right, stay with us, Bill. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. Bill Blunden with us, his book, Behold a Pale Farce. We're talking about cyber wars, or the lack of them, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. We're with Bill Blunden. He's the co-author of the book, Behold a Pale Farce. Bill, why do you think the threats are not real?
Well, it's how they're painting the threat. It's how they're casting it, how they're framing it. And so they frame it in a certain way, and then they offer their prescriptions based on that framing. So in other words, they... by using the word war, they're framing this as a military problem. And that lends itself naturally to military solutions. You might ask, why is this threat being inflated? Why are they painting this as an existential problem? And I think that since the end of the Soviet Union, since it disintegrated, really, the defense industry is trying to maintain strategic relevance in terms of its budget and in terms of its status in D.C. And there was a book that a CIA officer named John Stockwell wrote many years ago, and the title of the book was In Search of Enemies. And I think that's actually an accurate description of what's going on. They need reasons to maintain that strategic relevance. They're looking for them. And as far as they're concerned, cyber is a growth opportunity for them, and that in addition to drones. And so the Pentagon has this, over $500 billion budget. And they need to find reasons to justify it and to maintain it. If you ask them why they need it so much, they'll use suitably vague terms like national security or something, we need to protect ourselves. There's threats out there. We need to protect ourselves. But the truth is that this huge budget, it channels a lot of money to a relatively small sector of the economy, to a relatively small group of people, and they just happen to have their hands on the levels on the levers of power in D.C. I think that's really it's not so much that there's not threats, but it's how they're painting the threats and the kind of solutions that they're offering against those threats.
And you think that that could be true, that they're trying to create their own livelihood. They need something like this in order to continue to get funding. I bet the war on cyber war is going to be huge now, the budget for that.
Yes. They pump something like $70 billion into our intelligence agencies, which is more than, that some countries spend on their militaries in total. The $500 billion that we spend over the $500 billion, it's double what China spends. And if you took the remaining countries and you added up what they spend, it would be more than that put together. So we really are head and shoulders above everyone else in terms of what we spend, in terms of what we put into it. And one model you can kind of use to understand this is what's known as the Hegelian dialectic. It's a philosophical model. It was developed a long time ago by a philosopher named George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And it's basically a three-stage process. He viewed history as a process of conflict, and this conflict consisted of three phases, three stages. He said there was usually some sort of initial event known as, he called it the thesis, some sort of initial development or thing that would arise, and he said that this thesis would incite its own opposing response. And this opposing response is known as the antithesis. So the thesis and the antithesis enter into struggle, and that duking it out process is known as synthesis. And as synthesis continues on in processes, it gives rise to a new thesis. So what's the use of all this? Why is this model useful? It shows that if you can control the nature of the conflict between the thesis and the antithesis, you can manage the outcome. You can manage the synthesis. So, in other words, to now take this threat, this process of threat inflation, put it in the context of the Hegelian dialectic. The thesis is this perception of an existential threat. They're painting this existential threat, and the antithesis is the emotional, the anxiety, the response by the public. This kind of this crisis mentality that results, the public sees this message of existential threat and becomes anxious.
Sure. They buy into it.
Yeah. And as a result, the synthesis of this is that you can entice the public. Now they're susceptible to these preconceived solutions, right? So if you frame something in terms of war, what is it? Well, if you, in matters of war, who do you go to? Well, you go to the Pentagon, right? So it lends itself naturally to military solutions. And that's really what they're trying to sell. And when I say who, I'm using they a lot, and I'm referring to these people in aggregate. Who are these people? Who's who's promoting this idea. A lot of times it'll be someone in government, some high-level ranking official from the Pentagon, like Leon Panetta. You know, he's used the term a Pearl Harbor event to describe, you know, that's the metaphor that he used at, in one instance. He called it, you know, we don't want to have a Pearl Harbor, you know. And, other times it will be maybe a think tank, someone from a think tank who might be from government, like Paul Kurtz, who moved out of government and went to a company called Good Harbor Consulting. He developed this term called Cyber Katrina, right? And then there's Mike McConnell, who is kind of the epitome of this. He actually has used a couple of different metaphors. He's used the term Cyber 9/11. He's also used the term cyber war. He had a famous op-ed piece in the Washington Post where he talked about we're engaged in a cyber war and we're losing it. And that claim was also echoed by Mike Rogers, who's the current head of the House Intelligence Committee. So Mike McConnell started off as the director of the NSA, and he left to go into Booz Allen, where he ended up making something like $2 million a year. And then came back into government through the revolving door to become the director of national intelligence. And upon leaving, he went back into Booz Allen in Hamilton. And so you can kind of see what's going on. And, you know, there are news outlets like The Economist who will use cyber war on their covers and kind of publicize it that way. So there are all sorts of, you know, you have these officials, you have these think tank fellows, you have former officials, you have just in corporate, you know, the McAfee had a report that came out called Virtually Here, Cyber War. And so these are kind of the sources. There's a term that a researcher named George Smith has used to kind of refer, he calls it the cult of cyber war. The idea that this is kind of this outlandish idea of cyber war, and these people who are promoting it, they are a part of this cult, the cult of cyber war.
So you don't think at this point there's anything we should be worried about?
I think there's plenty we should be worried about. It's just that how are we going to diagnose it? How are we going to treat it?
Well, that's a good point. So yep. How do we?
Well, I think that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we deal with cybercrime, we deal with espionage, we deal with sabotage. And, you know, typically dealt with crime and espionage. We have ways to deal with that, and neither of them involve the military. Same thing with terror. You know, it's only recently that we've used terror as a military solutions for terror. You know, typically we've relegated that to the FBI, and we haven't involved the military. So I think, you know, in terms of how we need to use traditional mechanisms. I don't think there's any easy way to deal with cybercrime. I think that it's always going to be time-intensive, resource-intensive, and a grueling process where you develop leads, you wait for opportunities, you develop informants, and it's traditional police work. I don't think it's a military problem. I don't think it requires a military solution. Ditto that with espionage. And with terrorism, typically the FBI is the entity which has dealt with terror threats. And unfortunately, you know, since 9/11, we have kind of deviated from that path and gone a different way. So I think on a day-to-day basis, we have these threats, crime, espionage, occasionally sabotage, but, you know, they're not existential threats. I think that, you know, If you wanted to, you know, if you don't look at the existential threat, you know, climate change, you know, the scientists at the UN are pretty convinced that if we don't do something, we're going to have an extinction event.
Well, they are.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there are definitely serious threats out there. But I think that the threat that's posed by crime and espionage, at least for the time being, they're not existential. And so we need to just treat them that way.
Let's we're going to get involved with the NSA. I want to get your take on Edward Snowden and some
sure.
other things, but
sure.
As you were putting this together, was there anything out there that concerned you at all?
Yes, it has to do with, well, the thing that bothered me the most is how they were framing the problem and the solutions they wanted to to give, you know, to promote. I thought the solutions that they're using right now are kind of undermining our liberty and our security, and it's benefiting a small group of people, and it's giving everyone else kind of the short end of the stick. It's security for the 1%, and I think that it's that is really what disturbed me when I realized what was going on. I think we have a top-down security model for the time being, and what we need is bottom-up security, where everyone has access to strong security and not just a small group of spies and crooks.
Most people are concerned, you know, they're talking about Windows XP is not going to be supported anymore. They've stopped it. You know, people are running around going, oh, my God, what am I going to do? Should we be concerned about things like that, Bill?
Yes. I think once the vendor stops patching things, you know, there's not much you can do. In the past, we really rely heavily on the vendors to patch their software and keep it as secure as they can. And the most that you can do as a user is to keep it patched. So when they stop releasing patches, you know, bugs are like roaches. If you find one, there's a dozen, maybe a hundred that you don't see. And so, you know, I think, people who are using Windows XP, they need to get off of it as soon as they can, because Microsoft won't even support it. They won't even look for bugs anymore. So it's going from bad to worse.
Well, there's no doubt about that. What do you think of Edward Snowden? Patriot, hero, or a traitor?
I think he's a whistleblower and kind of a lantern holder. I think he's shining light on a lot of stuff. You know, they called Daniel Ellsberg a traitor, yeah, and a criminal. And I think that history has
well, they've redeemed him.
He redeemed him. And I think the same thing will happen for Edward Snowden. I think that, you know, 10, 15 years from now, he will, you know, history will prove that he did the right thing in terms of what he's exposed. I think that the whole excuse that he's undermining, you know, what he's doing is hurting our security efforts is ridiculous. I think these are things that we actually need to know about, because the programs that they have right now are undermining our collective security, and the damage is that we don't know about this, and we can't have an open discussion as a democratic society about it.
Would you let him back into the country? Would you just simply say, hey, we're forgetting anything about this? No charges. Don't worry about it.
Oh, heck, I'd give him a parade and a medal, you know?
Well, I've said that too, Bill, because you know what? What he stopped and what he has brought to the public's eye and ear has been something of illegality.
Yes. Yes. It's just mind blowing. If you know, and this it's really weird, because I had stuff, certain things I could kind of infer and imply based on what I knew in when I was originally writing my book about 4 years ago. And I didn't have concrete confirmation. So there was a limit to how strong a statement I could make. So if I'd actually come out and said some of the things that I was thinking of, people would have said, this guy is a tinfoil hat wearing nut. And it turns out that the paranoid mindset is actually the accurate one. You know, it turns out our worst fears are confirmed, you know, so it's not just paranoia. It's right on the money. The worst case scenario is right here. You know, we've met the enemy. He's us.
I wish he was not in Russia, but they took him.
Yeah, there's this line that he's some sort of Russian spy, and I don't understand it, because the only reason he's there is because they voided his passport. What else is he going to do? And the fact that he was on TV with Putin, well, I'm sure that some people gave him a visit, and he probably wasn't in a position to say no.
Yeah, you know? We want you on this show,
yeah,
right?
Oh, well, okay, fine, yeah, whatever. Don't hurt me.
That's right. You know? And here are the questions they ask.
That's right. So,
well, I don't know. Do you think he's ever going to be allowed back in?
That is an excellent question. I think that if he's almost tied, you know, with whatever happens to Julian Assange. I think they're both, you know,
they're very similar
stuff. Yeah, and I think that if one comes back and is allowed to come back, the other will also be allowed to kind of roam free. But I hope that someday he's allowed to come back and kind of, you know, live in a free society and not have to worry about intelligence agencies taking action against him. but I have no idea what will happen. You know, nothing's written here. And we just have to hope for the best, you know.
Do you trust government, Bill, at all?
Well, when you use the term government, it's a big term. I think that what we have is a crisis of trust at the moment. Back in 2008, in that collapse, for example, in 2000, we had what was known as the Commodities and Futures Modernization Act. And they told us that it deregulated the derivatives market, so they wouldn't touch it with regulatory measures. And they told us that was perfectly safe. And they told us that these AAA mortgage securities were safe.
Yeah.
And it turns out they were just lying right through their teeth. In fact, some
and they knew.
Yeah.
And
Goldman Sachs. Yeah. And so I think the same type of thing is happening here. We've been told, that even Obama, he's on Charlie Rose saying we don't do warrantless wiretaps. There's always a warrant. And he said it's just like on TV that we need a warrant to do. But I don't understand how a constitutional lawyer like Barack Obama can get, the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and Section 702 wrong, that you can tap someone's phone without a warrant. And I the fact that he said we're not engaged in economic spying, and this is all about counterterrorism to keep us safe from terrorists. And again, these turn out to all be lies. And I think that, again, the propaganda technique that's being used here is something that's called the big lie. It's a lie that's so audacious that you couldn't believe someone would be so bold.
It's so bizarre.
And lie to you. And it kind of harkens back. When I think about this, I think of the Pike Commission that was formed back in the 1970s. In 1974, Seymour Hersh published an article in the New York Times about a CIA program called Operation Chaos, and it was about the CIA monitoring civilians. It's surprise, surprise. And that sparked a whole bunch of stuff. One of those things that it kind of launched was the Pike Commission. And Otis Pike was a representative who kind of led it. And the results were, I guess, troubling enough that they classified it, troubling enough to the CIA that they classified it. They didn't want to release it, although some of it did leak out through the Village Voice. In a nutshell, what Pike discovered was it wasn't just one bad apple in the barrel, right? And that's an argument that a lot of people are using, that, well, this is just General Keith Alexander. He's just a cowboy. It's all him. I don't buy any of that. Those agencies are obedient arms of the executive. And it's not just one or two bad apples in the barrel. As Otis Pike found, it was the whole barrel that was bad. Right?
Yeah. There's no doubt about that. People want to track you? Give us your website, Bill.
I'm at belowgotham.com.
Simple as that. We've got it linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment, talk more with Bill Blunden about his work, Behold a Pale Farce. I'm going to ask him about that title. It's much like the late Bill Cooper's, of course, William Cooper, Behold a Pale Horse. We shall be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.